World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation in behalf of Admiral distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
America's B-29 super bombers have struck a powerful twin blow at the Japs, hitting Singapore's dockyards and repair shops and the big fuel refinery on the island of Sumatra. The 20th Bomber Command calls the attack against Singapore as the longest daylight mission ever flown by military planes. The big bombers flew from India, and at both targets, results are described as good to excellent. None of the B-29s was reported lost. The Japs, meantime, are saying that Allied planes have been on reconnaissance over the main Jap home island of Honshu. We've made good progress on Leyte in the Philippines. In Germany, the First Army has won back almost all of the territory it lost to the Nazis at the village of Smith, and the British are within gun range of the Maas on a broad front in Holland. And now for news direct from overseas, Admiral takes you to London. Richard C. Hotelet reporting.
The spotlight has for the moment shifted back to the air war in Western Europe. Our ground forces are engaged from Holland to Switzerland in comparatively small-scale actions, and in various places along the front where we are advancing, this progress is hard fought against determined German forces. It's only in the air that we hear once more of huge formations striking heavy blows at the enemy's strength. Once again today, the United States 8th Air Force sent 2,000 planes into the Reich to bomb railroad marshaling yards on the approaches to the Western Front. You'll notice that railroad and communications targets appear more and more frequently in the reports of air warfare. Even when large American forces concentrate on oil and industrial targets, there are usually smaller bomber formations and fighters going after key railroad junctions and yards. And along with the great armadas of heavy bombers, the medium and fighter bombers of the tactical air forces are streaking out to hit smaller targets behind the German lines. It reminds you of the time before D-Day, when roads and crossings and bridges and railroad installations were pounded incessantly, hit again and again to pin the enemy down and give us the advantage of mobility. And once again in this great offensive, the RAF is sending its Lancasters and Halifaxes roaring out by day and by night. More than 1,000 of them dropped over 3,000 tons of bombs on Bochum and the Ruhr last night in the face of a flak barrage as heavy as anything ever put up in the Battle of the Ruhr and of great German fighter opposition. I'm told on good authority that the output of German fighter planes has never been higher than it is right now because we've been concentrating on bombing other targets. The enemy hasn't enough fuel to sustain an effort by his fighter force, but he probably has gas enough to get large numbers of fighters into the air in emergencies. On the air, as well as on the ground, we've still got stiff fighting ahead. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
For a report from the American First Army front, where the battle for the town of Schmidt continues today, Admiral takes you to the German frontier. Ned Kalmer reporting.
Today is Sunday over a large part of the so-called civilized world. And here in the German frontier region, it's been the kind of Sunday that makes you realize how people struggle to keep on living normally and decently, even in the midst of war. Most of the front is quiet, and in rest areas behind the lines, in occupied towns where the real husbandmen were doing their jobs, doughboys went to mass today in the little churches. Or if they had nowhere to go, they spruced and shined themselves up anyway, like Sunday back home, just for the sake of feeling right. The civilians here, the men and women whom war has left behind, also were out in their Sunday best. Life can and must go on, their faces seem to say, even when the long toms boom regularly a mile or two off, and the awesome passage of 50 flying forts thunders overhead. The war is always there, but they don't want to notice it anymore. You hear them in small groups talking about the peacetime thing. You notice how proudly they dress their children with whatever finery they have left, and how all that remains of a half-ruined house is swept and polished till it glistens. Today, there was sunshine, which is unusual around here. The late autumn countryside was a glory of color, and many an American soldier, waiting quietly in this atmosphere for the next phase of violence, must have asked himself, why wars are necessary at all. It's a day like this when fighting men have a moment to think, when so much in people and in nature seems good and beautiful, that makes that question the most tragic of all we know. This is Ned Chalmer with the American First Army. I return you now to Admiral.
More news in just a moment, but first here's Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral Corporation.
Of all the wonderful things to come in our post-war era of better living, probably none will be more labor-saving to the American homemaker than the Admiral Home Freezer. For the Admiral Home Freezer will provide for your own family's needs as well as for unexpected guests.
Mr. Sweeney, didn't I hear you say a few weeks ago on this program that the Admiral Home Freezer would simplify meal planning? Just how?
Well, for one reason, your Admiral Home Freezer will keep large varieties of foods for months and months within a few steps of your kitchen. So it'll be simple to have well-balanced meals every day. You can prepare foods far in advance to be used as wanted. And you'll never waste leftovers, for you'll freeze them to be kept and used another day. You'll be able to cater to individual tastes, too.
Yes, I can see that'll be grand. But isn't the Admiral Home Freezer difficult to install and expensive to operate?
No, just set it where you want it and plug it in, that's all. And it's certainly not expensive to run. The operating cost in the average home is only about 3 cents a day. From a standpoint of health, an Admiral Home Freezer will be a grand investment. And its quality is assured when you remember it is built for the makers of Admiral Dual Temp Refrigerators, Admiral Electric Ranges, and Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set. Now, here once again is Douglas Edwards.
For an interview with a Wilmington, Delaware ensign who watched a Jap carrier sink out in the Pacific, Admiral takes you to Pearl Harbor, Webley Edwards reporting.
A scene that will live long in the memories of Navy men was the great carrier action between Admiral Mark Mitcher's fast carrier forces and the Japanese in the Second Battle of the Philippines. An eyewitness was Ensign T.W. Stevenson of Wilmington, Delaware, who was attached to Admiral Mitcher's staff. Steve, will you tell us about it?
When we hit Nansai Shoto and Formosa, the thought was in everybody's mind that the Japanese fleet might come out. If it did, we knew it would be the biggest naval event of the war. Our boys figured we could take them. Then on the morning of the 24th of October, we were attacked by Jap planes from the Philippines. The Princeton was just off our starboard quarter when she was hit. We saw her blow up, and it was pretty dismal. Yet even that gloomy hour had its light of moments. During the rescue, one of the Princeton's mess boys came aboard. A former buddy, a mess boy on our carrier, said, "What you doing here, boy?" To which he replied, "I's surviving."
Did that action continue all day?
That afternoon, a large group of enemy planes, as many as 150, came in from the northeast. Then we knew the Jap carriers had come out. Everybody was excited as a debutante. This was the day everybody had been waiting for. The Jap carriers were located late that afternoon, too late to attack, but we knew that we had them and that the big moment was near.
When did you get contact?
About 2 a.m. The two fleets were about 90 miles apart at that time. The Japs apparently turned north, and we went after them. Our first strike got away before sunrise and got the Japs about 7. It was a perfect setup because the Jap carrier planes launched against us the previous afternoon had gone on to Luzon to refuel and for replacements, which they badly needed. We caught them with only a few planes, perhaps about 20 among the four carriers. That meant no aerial opposition, and our carriers were free from attack, which speeded up our strikes.
Well, this was the action that sank the four Jap carriers, then.
That's right. Commander Hugh Winters of Society Hill, South Carolina, had a grandstand seat for one of the greatest shows ever seen. As target coordinator during 3 strikes, from his fighter plane up above, he watched 3 Jap carriers hit and sunk. He's the only man outside of the Japanese whoever saw 3 Jap carriers go down in about 4 hours. He said the most beautiful sight was the big Shikoku-class carrier with 3 gaping torpedo holes in one side turn over and slowly go under.
Your carrier was close enough to see one explode, I recall.
Yes, and that's very unusual for carriers to get that close.
Now, what of Admiral Mitscher during this exciting time?
The thing that impresses everybody about him is his calmness and self-possession. He never raises his voice, and he eats ice cream while his aides relay reports to him. As the flyers would come in and report excitedly to him, a smile would come over his face of satisfaction and of appreciation of the boys' excitement, for he is a flyer himself. Once, after the Tokyo radio had announced again that his flagship had been sunk, his chief of staff, Commodore 31 Knot Burke, said, "Well, Admiral, I see the Tokyo Rose sank your ship again last night." And the Admiral said, "Yes, I'm getting mighty tired of swimming around in the Pacific every night."
How was it when the battle was over?
Like the locker room after a football game, with everybody talking at once.
Well, they might, Steve, after helping to win a great and vital sea victory. Thank you, Ensign T.W. Stevenson, for your highlights from aboard Admiral Mitscher's flagship during the Second Battle of the Philippines. This is Webley Edwards at Pearl Harbor. I return you to Admiral in New York.
And now for a direct report from headquarters of the Allied Command in Italy, Admiral takes you to CBS Rome, Winston Burdett reporting.
Rome is a city of striking contrast 5 months after our arrival here. It is an idle, restless, hungry city where the rich continue to live and eat extravagantly well thanks to the black market. Middle-class people, professionals, and office workers are tightening their belts and selling their clothes and their furniture to buy food. A large section of Rome's working class faces continued unemployment this winter. Those who have the money can supplement their rationed foods on the black market. But for those who don't have the money, for the great majority, soaring black market prices mean progressive destitution, undernourishment, prostitution. There is no starvation in Italy. There is hunger and discontent. In several cities, there have been food riots. Over this troubled situation presides an Italian government, which most Italians regard not as their government, but as an emanation of the Allies, a collection of political lobbies which we brought into being. The Italians either respect or trust this government. The government does not trust itself. It is a sick state of affairs. And it is not helped by the presence and the background of an important group which is not represented in the government at all, but which is now renewing its agitation and gaining ground, the monarchists. The monarchy still plays a significant offstage role, and monarchists privately admit that they have everything to gain in this period of uncertainty. The Bonomi government is afraid to face any crisis squarely, because a crisis might force a cabinet shakeup. And a shake-up would automatically place the task of forming a new government in the hands of the Crown Prince. This offstage role of the monarchy is a main factor in keeping the political scene here in a state of morbid suspense. The Italian papers are writing of the possibility of civil war after the Allies leave. And it is true that many Italians are thinking in these terms. Everyone is looking ahead to the liberation of northern Italy. The anti-fascist parties expect to find a greater political awareness, a more dynamic and decisive political force among the partisans of the North and the industrial workers of Milan and Turin. The anti-fascists have a word for this. They call it the North Wind. They hope that it will sweep away the debris of fascism that still clutter the Italian scene. The rich of Italy are also looking ahead. Indeed, many wealthy and property persons are already making their plans for leaving Italy after the war and for transferring their fortunes abroad. They envisage with fear the liberation of the North. They talk of civil war, of communism. They say frankly that they hope Allied troops will stay on in Italy to maintain order when it is all over. The rich and titled people of Rome dread the North Wind. This is Winston Burdett returning you now to Admiral in New York.
And here with us in our New York studio for a summary of the situation on the Eastern Front is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The forward sweep of the powerful Russian left wing seems to have reached the outskirts of Budapest, though there are some indications that German resistance is stiffening in the immediate vicinity of the Hungarian capital. It remains to be seen whether this resistance is going to develop into a major battle for possession of the city. On present evidence, it seems more likely that it is just a covering operation to permit the Hungarian Nazi leaders and their German accomplices to get out of town before the Russians come in and add these gentry to their bag of war criminals. At any rate, the Russian army paper Red Star, which is usually well informed on military affairs, is accepting the fall of Budapest as a foregone conclusion, and Red Star is not given to reckless optimism. One point of importance remains in doubt, that is, whether the Russians will be able to get any of the bridges over the Danube intact. More than likely, the Germans will blow up these bridges before they retire. It's therefore quite possible that considerable fighting will take place as the Russians attempt to force a river crossing. They may do this in the city itself, but are more likely to make a swing north of the town, first to cut off any German elements which might try to retire towards Slovakia, and second to reach the Danube at a point where a forced crossing could be more readily developed than among the closely built structures of the city. Once the Russians have secured Budapest and a firm crossing of the Danube in the city or its vicinity, there are two military opportunities which lie open to them. One is to advance northward toward the Moravian Gateway. This would involve, almost certainly, a coordinated thrust westward by the Russian armies in Poland. The twin advances would converge in the direction of Krakow and the Silesian industrial region. The other military possibility would be an advance up the valley of the Danube on Vienna. This would require a considerable extension of the Russian left flank, but might well be combined with the advance toward the Moravian Gate, provided that the Russians can solve their increasingly difficult supply problem. However, the basis of this solution is contained in the capture of Budapest, because Budapest, like many European capitals, is the center of the transportation system of its country. One of the rail lines linking Poland directly with Hungary is already in Russian hands, and if Budapest is taken, a comparatively slight advance along the remainder of the Russian line to the northward will give the Russians yet another and more important railway. Thus, Budapest may well become the main Russian base of operations in Central Europe. From it may be directed the push north to the Moravian Gate and the industries of Silesia, the push westward to Vienna, and even the mopping up of the region to the southwest as German resistance in northern Yugoslavia is slowly and painfully extinguished by the Russians in cooperation with Marshal Tito's partisan forces. If the Germans are to prevent these Russian accomplishments, they will need more troops and yet more troops. But more troops is something which the German high command cannot turn out in synthetic factories, however ingenious. Here again is Douglas Edwards.
For an interview with a Navy torpedo bomber pilot from Maryland who has seen action in Philippine waters, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Joe McCaffrey reporting.
Our guest today is just back from the now famous Battle of the Philippine Sea. He is Ensign Vanguard and Stauber, USNR, a torpedo bomber pilot of the Navy's Great Air Group No. 2. This flying group piled up 7,248 sorties in the Pacific, accumulating 23,202 combat hours. It shot 264 Jap planes out of the air and destroyed at least 275 on the ground. Its bombers and torpedo bombers sank or probably sank 402,000 tons of Japanese shipping. Ensign Stauber won his wings in October 1943 and now holds the Navy Cross. Suppose you tell us a little about your part in the first battle of the Philippine Sea.
Mine was one of seven planes which went in on the first attack of the battle. We stood by and watched our bombers go over in the dive. There were nine of the bombers, and they scored six hits. Then we started in, but the cloud coverage was so heavy, it broke up our formation. As a result, we went in on our own. I made my first run on the carrier, but pulled out alongside of it about 100 yards away. I reached down to close my bomb bays and found that I hadn't opened them.
That must have been an embarrassing moment.
There was no time to be embarrassed. I was just plain mad. But there was a cruiser dead ahead of me, so I blazed in on it. This time, I made sure the bomb bay doors were open. I caught the cruiser with a direct hit amidship.
At this point, how was the opposition?
They were throwing up everything they had. And after hitting the cruiser, I ran between two destroyers.
How was their defense in the air?
Only two fighters got inside our screen. One of these was shot down and the other got away.
Did all of your seven planes get back?
One of the seven went in the water and a destroyer picked up the crew.
I understand the Navy will do anything to rescue its flyers.
That's right. They're going all out to bring them back.
Your group was the first to hit the Philippines, isn't that right?
Yes, we hit Mindanao, and we sure did expect never to come back. It was really terrible, but only one airfield that we raided threw up ACAC. We did all right when we hit Manila, too. I knocked out a transport with a direct hit.
From our communiques, I noticed that even when our pilots are outnumbered by the enemy, they still turn in great performances.
I think this may be due to the fact that the Japanese pilot is too mechanical. Many times, large formations of Japanese planes have jumped American pilots, and although our boys have been outnumbered, they usually come out on top, running the Japs home. They can and do think things out as they go, but the Japs have one idea in mind, and if he's crossed up, he's lost.
You've been out there since January, and in that time a lot of things have happened. How does it look to you now?
Since then, we've gone from the Marshalls and the Gilberts to the Philippines, which is quite a hop. Even 10 months ago, we went where we wanted to in the air. But today our chances of doing that are better, and today our losses are smaller. But we've got one thing to remember, that as we get nearer the enemy's homeland, the fighting will be tougher. He will be fighting for shorter lines of supplies, and above all, he will be fighting for his defense of his home. There is no mistake about it. The moving ahead will be slower and harder the rest of the way.
You just heard torpedo bomber pilot Ensign Van Gordon Stauber, USNR. This is Joe McCaffrey in Washington. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
Well, in the actual fighting in the Philippines today, our troops on Leyte Island continue to make good progress. At last reports, they were driving on Pinamopoan, a key highway terminus on Carigara Bay. This appears to be a preliminary to an assault against Ormoc, which is 20 miles to the south. And the Japs are still reinforcing their defenses at Ormoc for a last-ditch stand. The Japs are reported to have resisted all attempts to break their stubborn roadblock at Pinamopoan, which stands guard at the northern end of the narrow Ormoc Valley Corridor. While General MacArthur's communique reports that the Japs have lost heavily in armored vehicles, trucks, and artillery, the enemy's effort in the air appears to be increasing. And front dispatches indicate that our troops on Leyte are getting the same sort of sleepless night treatment our Marines experienced on Guadalcanal in the early days of the Pacific fighting. There aren't many planes coming over Leyte, but those which have been showing up apparently are manned by very good pilots. And now, once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral.
You actually won't believe your eyes when you see how easily, how simply, the new Admiral automatic record changer will operate. Thousands of proud owners of Admiral radio phonographs before the war thought the Admiral automatic record changer was just about perfect, that it couldn't be improved. But the post-war Admiral changer will be so foolproof in design and so completely automatic in its operation that it's due to upset a lot of theories that record changers are complicated. Every manufacturer has tried to reduce surface noises in record players. Well, there will be a new Admiral electronic tone arm that will do away with practically all surface noises. This new Admiral tone arm will exert only 1 ounce of pressure, so your records are going to last a lot longer than before. And they'll be much safer, too, in the new Admiral automatic record changer, for there'll be less chance than ever of chipping or breaking them. Yes, it's to be expected that the new Admiral record changer will be America's finest because of Admiral's years of research and advanced engineering. Research and engineering that have made Admiral the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. If you are driving to your work and are not a member of a carpool, by all means join one now. The need for car conservation grows greater every day. The number of cars in running condition is several million less than when the war started. America must keep moving with its present supply of cars and tires. So conserve yours by joining a carpool today. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, and post-war makers of Admiral Dual Temp Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is Warren Sweeney speaking coast to coast for the Admiral Corporation. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is the WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago 11.